everyone, and welcome to In the Know with Kat Bobineau. Today, my extra special guest is Dr. Darren Gray, who is the director of the USC, Viterbi. K-12 STEM Center and coding camps. He's got a lot of pedigree behind him, so I'm just going to do the short version, which is a bachelor's degree in biomedical and electrical engineering from USC School of Engineering, a bachelor's in mathematics, a master's in teaching with emphasis in mathematics and education, a master's in cybersecurity, and a doctorate in education technology. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Awesome. So I gave a very short, brief version of all of your pedigree, but if you want to go into a better explanation, please do.
Okay, so as far as my undergraduate degrees, I have a short story of how I got into that area. I started in math and science when I was a young little tyke. I just love math and science. The story I like to tell is I have three sisters, and I didn't understand them, but I understood math. And so I love math because I didn't understand my sisters. You know, like, math never took my toys away. And if my sisters are watching, just kidding. So I learned that I was just really good at math and science. And so growing up in Detroit, there was only folks in our neighborhood who worked at the factory. So we didn't have any STEM professionals. And so the only STEM professionals I knew were my doctor and my dentist. And so I was not going to be a dentist because I hated my dentist. Not hated, but I hated the part of the dentistry. So I was going to be a doctor. And that was just my mentality. I'm going to be a doctor because I'm good at math and science. And then when I was in 10th grade, I was in a chemistry class with seniors. I was in the advanced chemistry class that we had at our high school. And there was a senior who I had a crush on. So she said, yeah, I think you would be a good engineer. I didn't know what an engineer was. Mm. But I was going to drive trains for her because, you know, she recommended it. So, but I did. And there was no internet at the time. So, you know, I had to go to the library to find out what an engineer was. And I was like, oh, well, that looks cool. And so then a friend of my sister's told me, after I found out about this engineering thing, a friend of my sister's, who was also at that high school, told me about a program called the Detroit Area Pre-College Engineering Program. And DAPSEP, I learned about engineering. I took my first computer science class in 1981. So over 40 years ago, that's when I took my first computer science class. And so I got a chance to learn about computer science. And after that, I was going to be an engineer. But I still had that inkling for medicine. And so I looked at all the schools. And again, there's no internet in these days. You'd have to actually go to the library and look up schools.
Right.
And so I looked at all the schools that had a way in which you can do engineering and medicine. And that's when I discovered biomedical engineering. Hmm. And there were only a few schools in the country that had biomedical engineering programs, and USC was one of them. And also, I was in Detroit, and you know, I told my mom that I could not do calculus and snow. So I was definitely a warm climate to go to. And so biomedical engineering, I took myself out west and started in biomedical engineering. And then after my first semester, there was a lot of electrical engineering that was involved. And so I talked to my advisor and I was like, you know, tell me about this electrical engineering. And she said, well, you can double major in you have biomedical and electrical engineering. And I was like, oh, cool. So, you know, I added that degree. And then when I was getting closer to graduation, I wanted to get a math minor. And so I went to the math department and said, hey, how do I get a math minor? And they said, well, if you stay an extra year, you can actually get a math degree. And I was like, well, that sounds cool. Because I really wasn't ready to graduate anyway, because that meant working forever. You know, when you're a student, you get summers off. They're days off. And I'm like, I can take another year. And so that's where the, you know, biomedical and electrical and math. And I worked for Hughes Aircraft for a number of years. And then I did some engineering consulting. And then I got into education. Someone asked me, was I interested in teaching education? And so I started teaching in the LA Unified School District, which is the second largest school district in the country, at an alternative high school. And I was just having a good time. You know, I do some engineering consulting here and teach students. And, you know, I love math and I would teach them about math. And I had such an exciting time about math. And there's something about somebody who's enthusiastic about math. They love it. But then after the 2008 recession, there was a shift in how kids related to education. they were no longer buying the American dream, go to school. You know, they were like, well, we saw what happens. People went to school, got degrees, and now they lost their jobs. Mm-hmm. And so whole different mentality where kids just, I couldn't figure out how to motivate kids. Before, it was like, if I can show you how much you love math, then you will take math. But now they were like, we don't like school. And I was like, I don't know how to solve that problem.
Right.
And so, you know, I was an engineer as a teacher, so I would always, it was always problem solving. And so I realized, I was like, I don't have the skill set to solve that problem. I don't know anything about that. That's why I went back to school to get the master's in education. I had to understand, you know, kid psychology, because before it wasn't an issue. Kids wanted to go to school. They wanted to learn math, but they didn't have math teachers that could teach them. So I could do that. So that's when I went back to school for that. And then I got a whole different perspective on teaching. And so then I was able to re-engage with the kids again, and I was back to being, you know, doing cool things. And then I started looking at the digital use divide. So we have the digital divide, and those, you know, the instance of people not having access to the internet or computers and everything. But after the smartphone, that kind of decreased because kids had access to the internet, they had access to information, but there was this digital use divide. The digital use divide is how you use technology. So kids were using technology for games and social media and all of those things, whereas their counterparts that went to more affluent schools, they were using it for understanding, you know, engineering research, the economy, banking. It was a whole different perspective. And I was like, oh. And again, I don't have to solve that problem. So that's when I went back to get my doctorate in education technology, because I wanted to see how the way in which people utilize technology, whether it's using robots to learn or using a learning management system to reach kids who couldn't come to school because of homelessness, because of issues at their home. You know, they still need to be able to get to school, but there were physical restraints. Kids that are in foster care may not be in the same foster care where there's foster care home where their school is. They may end up across town. So how do we utilize technology so that they can still have that connection to that school where they have built an infrastructure support system? So that's why I went back to get my doctorate. And then along the way, I started to see this whole, it was pre-pandemic, I started to see all this whole education technology, and I was all excited about it. And then I started to look and go, wow, that information is not really secure. It's just all out there. And so that's when I went back to get my master's in cybersecurity, because I was like, you need to have all this, but you also need to understand how things work in terms of cybersecurity. So that's the Reader's Digest version of my academic career.
Well, there you go. That was like a dissertation, but I appreciate it. You know? Just a reminder, thank you to everyone who's joining us live on Facebook and YouTube. You know, thanks for putting comments in the chat. We can see them. DJ, love DJ. She says DJ. Hi, and so happy you're on the podcast. You're her STEM bestie.
Yes, yes.
I feel like I need to steal you from her. She's also my STEM bestie, so I think this could be a STEM three-way.
Yes, exactly. We can all be besties, at least.
Yes, I'm with that. Yeah. You know,
that's how the young people do it. People have multiple best friends now.
She said no. She said, do you have enough degrees? That's a lot of degrees. I mean, we're seeing some of them in the background. I don't even think that's all of them, right?
No, that's all of them. The one that's a little bit tarnished, that's the double major degree. So that one's there. What was interesting is when I got my degrees, when I graduated my undergrad from USC, I tossed them in the box and they stayed in the box. And then when I got my, all of them, the BME and the biomedical intellectual and the math, they were in the box. And then when I got my master's, I tossed it in the box and they stayed in the box. When I got my doctorate, my wife's like, that's not going in the box. So she made me frame all of my degrees. I mean, they were really in the box. So like the discoloration is from it sitting for, let's see, I graduated in 1988 and it did not come out of the box until 2018.
Oh, wow.
So okay. I just sat in the box.
Yeah, it's just like, we're not going to even think about this. I got
tossing the box. I was like, who needs it? But my wife did, she did say, because I have them at work displayed. And one of the things she said was, she said, it's important for kids of color to see what you've done. Because I was like, Like I'm just collecting them. They're just in a box. I don't need to look at them. I know what I have. I have my transcripts. But she said it was important to. So like if you walk in my office, it looks like I have a wall of Darren. It's so embarrassing. but my wife, she works at the preschool that happens to be next door to my office, so she can see my office from her playground. Wow. And she looks to make sure everything is there every day. She's like, all right.
She's like, if I look up and I don't see that, there's a problem. Well, she's a smart woman and she's right. You need to post them, and kids of color do need to see what they can do and what they can accomplish, which is a part of the reason why I do the podcast. Yeah. Because we want to be able to show all the types of accomplishments in STEM that kids can do. So I appreciate all your hard work, and I appreciate your wife making you do that.
Yes, yes.
So a couple of things. Van said, hey, so what's up? Hey, right back at you. Alon, good comment. I never thought about how the 2008 recession affected the mentality of getting a degree. You know, there was so many stories about PhDs as waiters and waitresses and driving. I don't know if Uber and Lyft was out. They weren't out yet. But, you know, doing these jobs that you don't need a degree to do. And it was all over the place.
Yeah, and it altered the way kids looked at education. I mean, it was a fundamental. Because it was odd, because working in the alternative school prior to the Great Recession, I would get the kids that would get kicked out or dropped out or pushed out of regular school, and you know they were just dying for an opportunity to prove themselves, and we were tearing it up, gangbusters. Those kids were just like excelling because they finally had somebody who believed in them. They had a system, and then after that, I was getting kids who said, "Well, I just don't like school." And I was like, I don't even know what that means. What does liking school have to do with you going to school? I have no idea. I had no frame of reference for that. But I started to see that them seeing how people who followed the rules, who did everything that they were told to do, are now unemployed or underemployed, losing their house, not able to pay bills. And it was in across the board, across the spectrum, across race, across every level that I dealt with in the public school system. Kids were just like, what's the point? If I'm going to end up back here doing the exact same thing, working at the exact same place, it's like, at my fast food joint, I got folks with master's degree. If I'm going to end up here, why go through all of that? Like I make the same amount of money as the person with a master's degree. If I'm going to end up here 20 years from now, what's the point?
Right. And so, and I get it. You're going into debt, going to school to be there.
Yep.
And that's a hard pill to swallow.
Yeah, and so it just shifted. And so then it became about teaching kids how STEM and how education impacted their day-to-day life, because we didn't make those connections before. And so it'd be, prior to the Great Recession, take math, get a good job. There was this formula that you followed. After that was, there's enough clean food, air, and water to last the rest of my lifetime. I can't say the same about yours. So you may want to learn something about some math and science so that you can breathe and eat and drink water. That was a different motivator. The kids are like, okay, I can go to school for that. I can go to school because I'm afraid that we won't have enough clean water. And I always talk to the kids, particularly here in California. I say we have this giant ocean outside in Southern California, and there is a limited amount of fresh water across the planet. There are entire communities and cultures that don't have drinking water. Mm-hmm. And we pee in fresh water. And we pee in fresh water, because the water that comes into your house comes in one pipe and it gets split up. Yep. We pee in fresh water, and there's not enough fresh water. And so, and I was saying to kids, we have an ocean. We can bring, you can think about how you would redesign that. We don't capture storm water. We just dump it right out into the ocean. And so when kids started to see how STEM could impact their day-to-day life, then I was able to re-engage them, because what I learned when I got my master's in education was, if the kids don't want to do school for the reasons that people do school, then you need to find another reason for them to do school. And then you have to make the connections, not like the silly connections where somebody comes up with a math problem to exploit the community. Those drive me insane. No, but if I talk about, hey, how you have those issues of trash, people throwing trash in your community, what if you had a robot to clean those up every day? And the kids are like, huh, that might be a good, you know, that's money making. And then talking about entrepreneurship, where like if you have a certain skill set, you can create your own job. It's independent of the economy. You just have to know what people want and have the skills to give it to them. And so right. we start talking to kids about that. And then explaining the importance of, you know, the arts as well in terms of math. One thing that and my sisters, if they're watching, they know this. I was a dancer in high school. And so one of the things that has helped me in my engineering career is that artists learn how to create from nothing. The creation comes from within. You know, mm-hmm. they have a feeling, they have a sense, they have a purpose, and they're able to generate and create things. Well, as an engineer, if you're given a project and you have no idea how to do it, you got to create from nothing. So you draw mm-hmm. on that art experience. So it's important to have that humanities as well. You have to have the English. You have to have the history to understand context. It's like, yeah, we tried this before. How can we do it differently so that it's successful? So there are all aspects of engineering, all aspects of math, science, all aspects of history, art, language. One of the things that I also realized in working in public schools, and if I'm going on, please let me know, because I can talk forever.
No, it's good. No, but you're making a good point, you know, with the whole idea of the education system. Why go to school? You know, mm-hmm. we have so many stories of the Mark Zuckerbergs and yeah. all that create a business with dropping out of college. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's like, well, why do I have to go to college? All these millionaires, you know, and then yep. this is personal opinion. Social media and media in general doesn't help, right? Yep. They highlight sports, they highlight entertainment, mm-hmm. reality television. Like, these are all quick ways to make money. Mm-hmm. And no one is pushing the idea of going to school, mm-hmm. getting an education, being an entrepreneur. Like, that's not pushed.
Yep.
And so kids don't see that.
Well, they don't see it. It's not represented. It's not cool. And, you know, they don't see that part. You know, they see the end result. They don't see, like, you know, and I tell folks that, you know, a lot of the, you know, the super billionaire rappers of today, like, I remember back in the 80s, before they were, you know, when they were, like, aspiring to, you know, follow the Curtis Blows and follow mm-hmm. the Grandmaster. I remember them all coming up. You know, I remember when, you know, the folks out here in L.A. were, you know, their rappers weren't even as cool as the New York rap. I remember all of that. You know, right. a lot of these guys have been in the game for 30 or 40 years. They didn't come out and just drop their first single and make, you know, millions. And so even then, or if you look at Kobe Bryant, Kobe was in he was practicing every day, all the time, you know. So they see the glory part, but they don't see the hard work that goes behind that. And social media doesn't necessarily, or the media in general, they don't necessarily talk about the hard work behind it. They only talk about the glory behind it. But right. you know, if you actually sit down and talk to some of these folks, they'll tell you, like, oh no, it's hard work. It's really hard work. And what I've always told kids is, you know, I will never tell you to make any decision. My job is to give you the opportunity to make a choice. And I always explain the difference between a choice and a default decision. A choice is, I got accepted to Harvard. I don't think I want to go. That's a choice. Mm-hmm. I didn't get accepted to Harvard, and so I'm not going to go. That's a decision that was made for you. That was made by default. If right. you did not apply to Harvard, that is also a decision right. that was made by default. The choice right. only comes when you have an opportunity for it. So sometimes when people say, I don't know if I want to work for so-and-so company, I'm like, did you get an offer?
that's a reality check that I know they're not feeling.
And then they go, well, no. I'm like, so you actually don't have a choice. That was a default decision. That was made for you, huh? And wow. you know, so sometimes people do that. And people confuse that, a default decision versus a choice. A default decision is you had no choice but to do that. Whereas a choice, you do have a choice. You actually say, you know, like, I'm choosing Google over Facebook. You know, I don't know which one I want, but if you don't have a job offer, that's not really a choice. So when people say, you know, I don't want to work for that company, my first question is, well, how much did they offer? Well, they didn't. I'm like, so that actually wasn't a choice.
That's not a choice. Right.
Yeah, exactly. You know what I mean? Like, I can say, you know, I don't want to play for the Detroit Pistons. Like, well, that's not really a choice because I'm not going to play basketball. It's just not going to happen. That's not really a choice. It's a default decision. So,
right.
So sometimes I have to explain that to kids to get them out of this mindset so they understand that to make a choice, you have to actually put yourself in a position to have options in front of you, because choices come from options. Default decision come from, this is where you're going to go no matter what. And there, it has impacts on your life, because there are a lot of things that kids don't know are default decisions. So if you want to go to one of the premier engineering schools, then you have to have calculus by 12th grade. which means that you need to be in pre-calc trig by 11th grade, which means you need to be in algebra 2 by 10th grade, which means you need to be in geometry by 9th grade, which means you need to be in algebra by 8th grade, which means you need to be in pre-algebra by 7th grade, which means that in 6th grade, the decision to whether you were going to be an engineer at a top school was already made by whoever programmed you into that class. So in 6th grade, whoever the teacher, school person, whoever picked your math class decided for you. And so you have a default decision. Now, you can interrupt that default decision by, you know, accelerating, taking two classes, going to community college. There are ways that you can disrupt that default decision, but you're already on that path to not go to MIT, USC, Harvard. You're already on that path. If you're not in pre-algebra by seventh grade, the decision's been made for you. And so sometimes people don't know that. And, you know, you can take that back further. You know, like, so if you have to be in pre-algebra by seventh grade, you have to have your multiplication, division, addition, subtraction, fractions, all that has to be down by sixth grade. So now you're going back into elementary school. If you don't have a good fourth grade teacher, you're done. And again, you don't get to choose your fourth.
That makes me feel some sort of way with my son, who's not even two yet, and I'm already trying to his life. But, I already picked some schools that I'm like, oh, this is a good school. You know, he can go to this school, and he's not even close.
But that's some of the things that, you know, in talking to some of the parents, I let them know that, you know, you have to give yourself the options way early. Like, your kid may not want to be an engineer. Your kid might be like, no, like my daughter, she wanted to be a computer science person until she took a computer science class. And she said, this is for the birds. I'm not doing this. Like, you don't get to talk with people. So she went to psychology because she's like, I want to help people. Because, you know, her perception of what a computer science person does was not what happened when she got into that class. She was like, oh. And so.
No, and that's something that, you know, my best friend and I talked about years ago before we even had children. And it was giving our kids, or, you know, imaginary kids at that time, options.
Yep.
You know, there are certain groups of people, I'm not going to say what, but there are certain groups of people who make sure their kids have internships or volunteer by the time they're in high school. They're taking them to places, programs. These kids are meeting CEOs and directors of programs, and they're already have a set job when they go to college.
Yep.
Like, you get your degree, you're coming out with a job, and
yep.
But that's not our culture,
no,
right?
No.
And that's not something we normally do, which is what she and I want to disrupt.
Mm-hmm. And that's what it comes from, is making those disruptions. And it starts by each of us having conversations like the one we're having conversations with teachers and parents and families and kids. You know, people need to know that there are certain things that are set in motion that you have to disrupt. Because if you just go along for the ride, assuming that the system will be fair, assuming that the system will look out for you. I mean, you know what's going on in the Supreme Court, you know, now where you have, you know, affirmative action. And, you know, here in California, public schools have always, because of Prop 209, we've always, you know, race was never allowed to be a factor. But you got a bunch of private schools here in California that did not have to follow that rule as strictly. Now everybody, and so our job now is to make sure that kids of color and girls have those same skills, those same opportunities, so they can be a competitive applicant. And right. what I always talked about parents is you just want your kid to be a competitive applicant. Because if you're a competitive applicant, then you've got choices. Because now you're like, who's going to give me the best offer? Who's going to give me the best scholarship? Like, athletes have that all the time. Athletes are like, oh, I'm going to
get
from this school and go to this school. Oh, I'm going to get into the transfer portal. Now they've got the likeness things. No, I'm so their athletes have all these choices. Well, what happens if parents thought about that for their kids? I want academic choices.
Right. You go to school for engineering and you got a table in front of you with four different hats.
Yep.
You know, people taking pictures of you and you're like, yep. I'm going to go to this school, and everybody's clapping. Right?
You know, exactly. Right. Yeah, you're right. Right. Well, probably more like protractors, not hats, but you know.
I mean, you know what I mean.
Or calculators.
I'm going to say hats. We got to get away from that stigma of the calculator. It's all calculators on your phone. You can do a calculation.
Yeah, we make the phones now. And the thing that I like in talking about this topic is, you know, giving kids, you know, those opportunities to start thinking about their future. You're not, it's the days of having the same job and staying in that job for 40 years are done. You need to constantly increase your skills. You need to constantly increase, you know, what you know, what you learn, and you have to make yourself marketable. I tell everybody who works for me, I have a staff over at the Viterbi School of Engineering, the K-12 STEM Center. I say, your LinkedIn needs to be up to date to the minute, man. You know, like, if I give you a new task, as soon as I give you that new task, you should be updating that LinkedIn. It's like, because you need to know, you know, they call it branding now, but it really is something about, you know, your identity, you know, your identity the world sees. And you need to make sure that your resume and your LinkedIn are always up to date. And, you know, you need to make sure that you're telling the best story about yourself, because, you know, you may have the greatest job in the world, but when that recession hits or that new boss comes in, you may not have the greatest job in the world, and you need to have options. And you also need to, you know, keep your eye toward entrepreneurship. If you have a certain level of skill, somebody may hire you just to do some work here and there. You know, our community, we've always had side hustles, but, you know, a side hustle could actually be more than your regular job. You know, you know, the thing that your regular job gives you is health insurance. Your side
doesn't usually give you health insurance until you grow it to the point where it can.
Yeah, then you can do that. But, you know, until you get it to that point, you know, you need to have that health insurance. And so there's a lot of things that there's generational knowledge that some of our kids don't get, because we've not really stored it and shared it the way it is. When my daughter was in school, I had spoken with a person of another ethnicity, and, you know, my daughter went to a private school, and he said, you know, you just need to give, because she wasn't really trying. And I was like, for this amount of money. And so she wasn't really trying. And so, you know, what I said was, you know, she needs to understand and value it. And he's like, oh, she'll eventually figure it out. And I was like, yeah, that's not going to happen. And so I told my daughter, I was like, you know, if you want these opportunities, you need to be exceptional. And she was like, I actually don't want that. That's you. She's like, I'm good. I can figure it out. But she had a choice. Right. And that was the thing. And you know, when I look at the choices that she made the right choices for her. But there were choices there. She was like, I can either go to this school or this school. She's like, you know, I'd rather go to a public school where at least I can be around people like me, who look like me, who have the same experiences as me, as opposed to going to a premier school where there's a whole different level of people and, you know, entertainers and things like that. And I was like, well, that's kind of cool, because that was my whole other paycheck. Like, I'll shave that money. But, you know, but she had a choice. And so we want our kids to be able to have choice. It doesn't matter what school you go to. It doesn't matter what the conditions in your community are. Because of the internet, you have access to information. But you need that knowledgeable other so that they can help you. And we need people of color who are in positions to be those mentors, to be that knowledgeable other. And one of the things I learned at the Rossier School of Education at USC, I know I'm a USC commercial, was the zone of proximal development. And the zone of proximal development is the things that you can do that are beyond your current capability if you have a knowledgeable other who can help you. So the ZPD is things that you can do if somebody were there to help you and guide you. And so what we need to do is understand that our kids have these amazing opportunities and these amazing raw skill sets. They just need a knowledgeable other to help guide them. And when one thing I learned in working with LA Unified was for the second language kids, the African-American kids, was that their language was a limiting factor for them, because their intelligence was so amazing and so significant, they didn't have the words to express their ideas. So they can have a great idea, but if you don't have the words to express your idea, then you can't get it across. And so now when you start teaching kids about, you know, 3D printing and computer-aided design, all of a sudden language isn't the barrier. You can sketch out that idea, put it together, and bring it into 3D space and say, this is what I'm talking about. Now you don't have the limitation of words. So STEM is important as a means of expression as well. If you can do, you know, equations or generate models or prototypes of your ideas, you're not limited to what you can say or how you speak. And what that's done for a lot of kids, particularly African-American kids, kids who are English language learners, is they start to see STEM as an avenue. I was working with some kids who were like theater people, and they were a zone of proximal development, ZPD. I was repeating, I saw the chat there. One of the things that I was working with some, you know, art kids, And, you know, I was like, hey, you know, you want to learn about 3D printing? They're like, nah. I said, well, what would happen if you could 3D print all those props instead of building them? They were like, tell me more about this 3D printing thing. And so those kids had to learn, you know, about computer-aided design. They had to learn more about geometry. They had to learn about ratios. So they had to learn all these were not math kids. These were like art kids. Were like, you know, to be or not to be. That's who they were. But they had to learn math and science in order to learn 3D printing so they can create the props for it. And they're like, this is easy because every year we can just press a button and now, you know, you don't have to keep building it from scratch. And so every kid learning about math and science is important because it impacts the world around them. And like I said, food, air, and water. Like, I can run out the clock. I'm like, there's enough for me. I'm good, you know?
You're right.
You know? And, but for, you know, the kids coming up and we want them to start thinking because they have to make decisions, whether they go into politics or law or sales or anything, they need to have that sense of STEM. And what's really weird to me is we have kids take music classes all the time and we don't expect them to be musicians, but there's a stigma that if you take a calculus class, you have to go into STEM. No. It's about thinking, expanding. We want kids to learn music so they can express themselves and learn the beauty of music. We should be doing that with math and science. It shouldn't be like the smart kids take math and science.
Right.
It should be everybody should take math and science because not only does it give you choices, it also helps you to think about things differently. It's like, you know, I took a piano class. You couldn't get me near a piano now because people's ears would start bleeding and everything. Like if you hear me singing outside the shower, like if you hear like the shower door, the bedroom door, the bathroom door, then, you know, there's a lot of filters. So I sound really good, but up close, you know, people's eyes start bleeding, but the singing, the dancing, all of that comes from, you know, learning how to be a person who knows how to express themselves. The same thing can be for math and science. So it's important that STEM be integrated into every aspect, as important as English language arts. You know, they used to talk about reading, writing, arithmetic. Well, it's important. And the other thing is important is we have such a technologically based world. Kids need to know why it works. So like, you know, when people, it's so funny, like people said, you know, well, I researched that. I'm like, did you, or did you just Google it? And then when I really want to mess with folks, I was like, so the Google algorithm engineers decided what you should learn. And then they go, well, that's not true. I'm like, you haven't cracked the Google algorithm. They know everything about you from the Google, everything. So they know how to tailor your search results to get you to click on something to buy. And it's a long process because the ultimate goal is to get you to click on something to buy. And so they will feed you whatever data will make you want to buy something. And so your search results are always going to be different than my search results. And so there's not a uniform search result. That's why it's an algorithm. If it were just plain searching, if I search for something, you search for something, we would get the exact same results. Why do you need an algorithm? Think about it. Why do you need an algorithm?
I agree with you. I'm just going to be like, you know, you've been on a tyrant right now.
I'm sorry. I just go on. I'm sorry. No. If you have any questions, go ahead.
No. What you said makes sense, which, I mean, all of it I agree with, right? It's just so much. I don't even know how to go back and figure out everything that you were saying, right. You know, but it all makes sense, right? So I just want to say, I'm just going to say, you know, I didn't know you danced in high school, but I've seen you dance.
You have. Yes, you have.
Yeah. So, but I do want to take it to the chat because I've seen a lot of things pop up, but I haven't had an opportunity to say any, or, you know, read them all. You know, DJ is cool with us being a bestie triad, a STEM bestie triad. And then, you know, she said you was in school when she was born. So that's, you know, that's cool. You're an amazing role model. Lim, though, he's like, you know, these kids, we were talking about kids in media and social media highlighting stuff. And he was like, these kids are about quick and easy money. It's a shame they don't know quick money is money someone can easily take from you. Mm-hmm. Because you don't know how to grow it and you don't know how to make it work for you.
Yep.
So, yeah, that's absolutely true. You know, if they're not taught finance, right, they're mm-hmm. not taught what to do with their money, it's easy come, easy go, right? Yep. So, you know, I was talking about my best friend in our conversations and, you know, now she's like, default decisions back by sixth grade is you speak in facts. Yes. And that's options. Absolutely. Lim, people of color do not understand options because we're conditioned to stay in particular lanes. Very true. Very true. I was talking to this about to somebody, you know, like we take it all back to slavery, mm-hmm. take it back to Jim Crow, you yep. know, yes, master this, you got to stay in your lane, keep your head down. Don't do mm-hmm. anything that's going to get you noticed. Don't get mm-hmm. do anything that's going to get you, you know, seen by the opposite or the, yep. the imposing people. And yep. that's enrooted in yep. us.
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely.
It's enrooted. So it's hard to get out of that. And it's hard mm-hmm. to even listen to people when they're trying to pull you out of that. Mm-hmm. I don't have an answer for that. Do you?
Well, what I've learned is my mom told me something a long time ago, like a long time ago before most people in your audience probably were born. She told me something a long time ago. She said, and what happened was I didn't get a particular award because the people who were giving out awards, they changed the rules so that this white kid would get this award. And so, you know, I came home and I was mad. I was like, and she said, "You let it get close." I was like, "Well, what do you mean?" She's like, "It never should have been close. If you let it get close and there's a toss up, you lose every time. Don't ever let it be close. You are in a world that is full of racism. You will mm-hmm. always be subjected to it, always. Accept it as fact and then figure out how you're going to move on from there. Because if you say the baseline underlying fact is this, how do I move on from there?" So like for me, I was like, I am a black man of a darker hue, and I am not taller than 5'8". So, so I'm not dunking. Like I can't sing, I can dance, but at that time there was no, you know, money in dancing. Now there is. And so I figured out in order for me to be successful, I need some pieces of paper. And that's what, you know, with the degrees you see me behind. It was like, I need to work my game. And, you know, I can do things. And so I figured out what will it take for me to get the things that I want. And so it was being very mission focused. And being mission focused means that there are times when I'm in meetings and somebody says something off color and I put it in my pocket. So I'm like, I don't have to say anything now. I'm going to hold that because you're going to do something and I'm going to pull that out of my pocket. Right. Like, I'm not going to complain today. I'm pissed off today. And I'm going to be pissed off and I'm going to be talking about you on my drive home. But that's just going to sit in my pocket. And when we're having a conversation and you bring up something that you think I did wrong, I can say, "Well, you know, when you called me a this, that really had an impact." And all of a sudden, what I did wrong doesn't matter because everybody's looking at you. You called him a what? You said what? And so I learned to control myself. There was, when I was working at Hughes Aircraft, there was a gentleman there, older African-American guy. And he asked me one day, he said, you know, back then we could actually say the N-word. He said, "What you gonna do when these white boys call you an N-word?" And I was like, "I'm gonna kick his," you know, he's like, "You're stupid." I was like, "What do you mean I'm stupid? I just graduated, I'm working, I'm in this." He's like, "You can give somebody that much power over you? You're stupid." And so I learned from that is like, you know what? I can control my responses in such a way that I can be strategic. Like if it's in my interest to be angry, then I will be angry. If it is not in my interest to be angry, I will not be angry. If it is my interest to go to HR, I will go to HR. If it is not in my interest to go to HR, so I'm always looking at what's my interest, because the goal is the mission, right? It's not how I feel at the moment. And one of the things that folks in our culture, we tend to think that the system will one day get it right. My mom was like, "Not gonna happen." Yeah. Not gonna happen at all. So
we thought everything was hunky dory when Obama was president.
Well, I knew. I was like, "Oof." And you know, I was like, "Oof." I was like, "It's great and all, but you know, people gonna let their guard down." And you know, like when people there's one young brother, and you know, I didn't mean to laugh when he said it, but he said, "You know, now, you know, you say something to a cop and you're afraid that they're gonna shoot you or kill you." I was like, "When did that? Was there a time when we could get something else? Like, when did I miss my opportunity? Right. Like, this has always been this way." But in his mind, because you know the change with Obama and we moved past it, he thought that the world had changed. I was like, "The world is what it is." And what my right. mom was saying was, "This is how it is." And if you operate from, it's like an engineering concept. I know what my constraints are, and since I know my constraints, I can design around my constraints, because that's what engineering is all about. You know, right. you have constraints. That's what science is about. You know the limitations. And so you use the scientific method or the engineering design process based on the limitations that you have. You know, you think about the folks who sent astronauts to the moon. You know, they nobody had ever been in space before. You know, they did all calculate. They knew, they worked from what they had. There were constraints on their design. You think about, you know, the folks that came up, everything from the polio vaccine to penicillin to COVID-19. There were constraints. In COVID-19, we were faced with a virus we had never seen. It was transmissible and fatal. And so now we could have been like, oh man, you know, 500 million people gonna die. So well, it's just how it's gonna be. Or
sucks to be you.
Sucks to be you. Hope I'm not one of them.
Right.
But as a scientist, as a mathematician, as an engineer, as a technologist, it's really about learning about working within the constraints and figuring out a way to have those constraints work to your benefit until you can get rid of those constraints or work around those constraints. And so those were things. I mean, think about, you know, the folks who were trying to make the first airplane. They were like, this gravity is something else. They didn't have like CAD designs. Like if you fly in a plane, you know, you're up in there because you got to control it. So, you know, that was a fatal experiment. And so the constraint was gravity. And so we were able to overcome that. Now we have planes going here and hang gliders. We figured it out. And so when you're talking with kids of color, one of the things about STEM that helps them is, like I told you, like math helped me to deal with my sisters. And so the thing with STEM is it helps them to deal with the world around them. And if they see the problems that are facing them, like, yes, okay, I go to a school and they don't offer calculus. Well, there are options for you. You can figure out what those options are. Or I can't go to school every day because of this. Well, there are options here. We've got virtual learning. There are lots of opportunities.
And so one
of the things that we want kids to learn, not just about being a STEM major, is learning the benefits of STEM.
Right. So Tavares said we need another session. Yes, because we can keep on going. A lot of it, yes, STEM, less things. We're going to get all of that. Dropping gems. We better preach at you, know, all of this stuff. You know. Oh, okay. You got a hello, Dr. Gray.
Hey, Jonah.
I've asked you to be on my podcast multiple times, ma'am. So I'm going to call you out. You need to respond to my messages.
And Dr. Figueroa.
Yeah, Dr. Figueroa. Anywho, yes. Replying to Lim's comment. Oh, yeah, he agreed. So, yeah, a whole bunch of yeses. Yay, cool. So, I think I'm caught up on all the chats. But, you know, you still, if you have questions or comments, please put them in there. Thank you for everyone joining us live on Facebook and on YouTube. But back to you. I mean, God, I don't even think we've touched bases on some of the stuff you've done. We've already hit like 45 minutes, and I don't even think we've talked about you for real, you know, outside of your degrees. So
tell me, ask away.
Yeah, you know I'm gonna say right now, you know, you're a director. What is your program at USC? What are you doing?
So it's the Viterbi K-12 STEM Center. And I'm sorry, my cat's in the background because
it's okay. Yeah. I'm glad my dog isn't barking. So better you than me, right?
So at the Viterbi K-12 STEM Center, our goal is to provide opportunities for kids of color to engage with STEM. And we do that in a couple of ways. We have school-based programs. We have programs on campus. We do teacher professional development. A lot of our USC students and our USC faculty go out into the community and host kids there. So we make the connection so that kids get an opportunity to experience STEM and not just reading about STEM, but by experiencing STEM. Mm-hmm. And we have a host of programs that allows us to do that. Our dean talks about the change in the face of STEM and providing opportunities and people finding out what their passions are. And he supports us in our vision of providing opportunities for kids to experience STEM. The president of our university has a strong focus and mission of diversity, equity, and inclusion for the university such that it's part of the university's core values. And so working in that environment allows us to do things in the community and allows us to build those partnerships so that other people can learn the things that we do and we can support one another.
Well, that's cool. You know, and that's one of the things that I look at being in Oakland. Like, we're both in California. I'm up in Northern California in Oakland. We've got premier schools surrounding Oakland, but they don't come to Oakland, right? There's no programs for real in Oakland. Oh, and there's a few here or there, but they're not as dedicated or thorough as programs that I've seen at USC, your program, DJ's program, and even, I don't know if Dr. Figueroa has a program, I follow her, but I see a lot of the marine biology and all the stuff that's done. But, you know, we have some stuff, I'm trying to position myself and be in a way that I can bring it to Oakland, you know? And the biggest thing about it is I'm doing it solo. Mm-hmm. I'm doing it without a school's backing or without, you know, certain museums that claim they want to do it. I talked to their CEOs. Yes, how do we get more Oakland kids? And what can we do for Black and Brown kids? And I'm like, here's what you can do. And they don't do it. Mm-hmm. Right? You know what I'm saying? They're like, oh, that's great. Thumbs up. But that's about as far as it goes. You know, so is this a program? I don't know. I went on a whole deep dive about myself. But is this a program that you're doing that you created? Or is this a program you walked into?
Sort of both. So our MESA program was started in Northern California, in Oakland. And it was started by a teacher who wanted to give Black and Brown kids access to math and science. It was before STEM was a keyword. And it started back about 50 years ago. And then the MESA program at USC started about 45 years ago. It was very small. And then I came to USC about a quarter century ago, and I started an elementary program, and then just kind of grew and expanded from there. And it expanded and expanded and expanded. It was a very small and limited program, and only focused on a number of schools. But in the time that I've been in my tenure here at the university, I've been able to expand it across by just creating partners. And the thing that I've noticed that brings people together is, you know, that excitement of that the kids get when they're involved, and then helping people to understand that you're not here as a savior. You're not here to, you know, change the world. You're here to just lower that barrier just a hair so some more people can climb over it. Mm-hmm. That's all you're doing. You're not coming to rescue anybody. You're not anybody's savior. You're not anybody's hero. All you're doing is chipping away at that barrier so that somebody can climb. And everybody's not going to be able to get over it because of your efforts. But if you chip it a little over here and somebody chips the barrier over here, then more people can participate. And then letting people be real about that, saying that this is what we're asking you to do. And what I find is that people are willing to do that if you frame it for them. And because what happens is when you talk about, when people say, you know, I want to do something for kids of color, and then you show them, well, here's what's required. They go, well, that's a lot of work. Yeah, right. That's a lot of money. Yeah. So, is there something else I can do for the kids of color?
right. Like,
can I write a song or something? You know, and so not there's anything wrong with songwriters. But sometimes what we have to do is we have to meet people where they are and let them contribute in the way that they can and be okay if that means, you know, just once. So I have some USC students who say, I can't really volunteer. I don't have any much time. I got too much going on. I said, if you give me an hour for the whole 4 years here, I'll take it. And they go, seriously. I'm like, yeah, if you give me an hour, and you know, that's all I need is an hour. And they're like, I can do that. And oftentimes they end up doing more, but sometimes they only do that 1 hour. But for that one kid, that hour made a difference. There's an old story that there was a kid throwing starfish. Had gotten washed up on the beach, and he's throwing starfish. They're like hundreds of thousands of them. An old man comes up. Are you really making a difference? The kid picks up one and throws it and says, I made a difference for him. And that's what we have to do, is we have to do what we can for whom we can with the people that are willing to come alongside. So, you know, sometimes like, I've got friends who, you know, a company will come to them and say, hey, you know, we want to invest in the community. And they'll give them a laundry list of things. And here's the bill. And the company's like, yeah, I'm not going to do that. I'm just going to donate to United Way. There's nothing wrong with United Way. But it was too much for them. And what I found is it's not that they're unwilling. They're overwhelmed. And when people get overwhelmed at the prospect of how awful things can be for some, it's an emotional turmoil for them, and people don't go places that make them feel bad, and so they want to go places that make them feel good. And so you say, you want to support us, let's start small and give them some momentum so they can build that emotional investment. If you come with your, you know, here's my $75,000 proposal for you to, you know, help me do this, they're gonna be like, they're not thinking about the money, they're thinking about, oh my god, we won't make a dent with that. And, you know, so where can I make a dent? You know, we're not doing it. It becomes this whole emotional thing that I have found with some of the folks, because it's not that they don't want to help. It's just, it's too much. It's too big, because they don't live this. Like, you and I, we live this every day, you know, like, doesn't matter how many of these things are behind me. When them red and blue lights flash behind me, I'm like, 10 and 2. Yes, sir. Right. No, sir. Yes, no. as a running, right. a running joke, we have an alarm on the building where I work at, and I'll tell my boss, I never get that code wrong. Never. Like, other folks will be like, oh, they'll call me. I forgot the code. Can you tell me? Like, yeah, okay. I ain't never got that thing wrong. So, ever. And so we experience it. And so we have learned coping mechanisms for the trauma that we see day in and day out. Your people, your allies who want to help, they don't have a coping mechanism because this is not their life. And so if you give them too much, too fast, they're going to back away because it's too painful. And I don't fault them for that because they've never had to deal with that. Like sometimes when I have some students from other countries that go out into the schools, you know, they go out into the schools and, you know, they're like, I can't believe in the United States, kids don't have access to computers. Like, how is that possible? And they're like having these emotions, like, I don't understand. This is America. How is that possible? I mean, they're going on and on and on. I let them have their thing. And I say, you made a difference today because kids got to see a young person come into their classroom and teach them about something cool. And then they're like, okay, I can go back tomorrow. But if I don't have that conversation, they're done. They can't handle that. They're like, I can't walk around with this emotional baggage and take my physics test tomorrow. I can't. So right. I'm not going back. Right. And so you have to right. meet people where they are and engage them in such a way that they can contribute in a small way. And if you get a bunch of different people doing that, you start building that momentum. And that's sort of what we've done over the last quarter century. We just started small. You know, I don't get to do the cool stuff anymore. I don't get to play with rockets and roll. I don't get into cool stuff. Like I was telling you before we came on, like it's mostly, you know, meetings and, you know, and doing things to keep the lights on. But right. when I first started going out, it was really just about generating that excitement and having kids learn and engaging teachers and engaging people in the community, engaging moms and dads in just a small way. Like your kid knows how to make a flashlight and that's just cool. And, you know,
so what you're saying is instead of going to all these different places and being like, give me the money because I got this grand idea I want to do for like 100 kids. Mm-hmm. I should be like, give me the money. So I can do it myself for 10 kids.
Exactly. And you can come help me. So you ain't got to do it. You can come help me. You can come to one of my, you know, I'm going to have a small little thing on a Friday, you know, doing some stuff. You know, bring a couple people around, you know, bring some donuts or something. You guys can just come hang out with us. And then they go, okay. And they go, huh, that was sort of cool. Okay. All right.
Okay.
And so you got to give them that opportunity to participate in the way that they can emotionally handle it. Like I said, this is our life. We've always dealt with this. We've always experienced it. It sucks mm-hmm. that we, you know, they have this new thing like trauma-based education or trauma-informed education.
Yeah.
So for us, this is normal. But when you have your allies or people who want to invest in the community, when they see the obstacles, the barriers, and all the things that our children have to overcome, they just can't handle it because there's a cognitive dissonance between the country that they believe they live in and the real country. And because of that, you know, people just emotionally can't handle it. So I'd rather, you know, I'm just go back home and watch my TV and I ain't gotta live with that anymore. And so right. part of it is allowing people to engage in a way that they can engage and being okay with that. You know, not being like, you got $40 million, you're going to give me $5,000. You know, not that. It's like, how are y'all?
Well, I be feeling like
how y'all going to do this? Like, you gave dividends. You know, you can't have that conversation. You'd be like, that $5,000 is going to help this number of kids, and your participation is helping. Like our advancement folks get upset with me sometimes when I say, when companies are like, well, how can we help? I'm like, well, the first thing is I need some engineers and some scientists to go talk to some kids. You know, the advancement people are like, and we need a check. I'm like, pay no attention to what Darren's talking about over there. We need a check. But I'm like, you know, money is important, but for some of my kids, they've never seen an engineer. And there's right. no difference between an engineer and Iron Man in their life because they both are fictional characters that they've never met. And so we need to break that down so they get a chance to interact with engineers and scientists, young, old, different races, so they can just see cool things because that's going to make the difference. Because what I share with my students and our staff is in our elementary school program, we may have one contact and never see that kid again. That kid may never have another STEM program in their life. That interaction has to be so impactful that kid chooses algebra in eighth grade and calculus in 12th grade. So we need to make those type of impacts every time we get an opportunity. And if that means that you have kids that are building, you know, paper rockets with an astronaut, so be it. Because if that astronaut comes in with a bunch of pictures talking about this is what I did, this is what I get, people are like, yeah, I can look that up on the internet. But to have built a rocket with an astronaut or an aerospace engineer, that's a different experience. That's something you remember for the rest of your life. That's like for a baseball player, you know, taking, you know, pitches from, you know, Kershaw. It's like, oh my God, Kershaw's throwing. You're like, if Kershaw came and did a presentation about this is how I throw a curveball, you'd be like, yeah, okay, whatever. So now, giving those experiences. So sometimes connecting with the folks out there in the community and having them connect with your kids is as important as the money. But I still take all checks. Turn away a dollar. So they still will take every check. But I also understand that has to be part and parcel is those connections and bringing people of color into the workplace and having them have those type of opportunities. So that's what the STEM Center is all about.
Okay, well, we got 4 minutes left.
Sorry. So
obviously, we're going to have to do a part two so we can email each other and call each other and figure out when you can come back because you're dropping a lot of gems on this, right? And so I can't just be like, you got 3 minutes to say something and then I'm done with you for the rest of my podcast history. It's just not going to work.
Yes, right? Absolutely.
So in these last few minutes, where can someone find out about you or if they wanted to get in touch with you, how could they do that?
Well, the easiest way is just to Google me. And there are two Darren Grays. There's me and then there's this jazz musician from St. Louis who, because he got a couple of gold records, he pushed me off the first page of Google. And then he and I have this running battle to get all the Darren Gray stuff. So I've got DarrenGray.com, DarrenGray.net, DarrenGray.org. He's got the Twitter Darren Gray. He's got the Facebook Darren Gray. So we've been battling. I'm 2 years older than him, so I have rights to the Darren Gray name. And so if you Google me, there's two people who show up. This great jazz musician, white guy, born in 2 years after me, and then there's me. So if you Google Darren Gray or Dr. Darren Gray, you'll see my Viterbi page or my LinkedIn page. And you know, usually, you know, the easiest way to get a hold of me is through LinkedIn. If you email, I get probably 300 to 400 emails in a week that I try to respond to. Our dean told me years ago that you want to respond to every email, even if it's that I can't get back to you right now within 48 hours. And so I try my best to make sure that I get back in touch with everybody. Not people who are trying to sell me things. I'm like, you send me a spam email, delete. But if you say, hey, you know, I'm interested in this, I'll try to get back to people. But the idea is, you know, LinkedIn is easier to get a hold of, you know, because sometimes people just have a quick question and I can share information right there.
Yeah, I just looked up DarrenGray.com and that needs some work. That website needs a little bit of work.
I stopped
on there and was like, I don't want him getting this.
So here's the thing. I'm HTML 1.0 and we're up to HTML 5. So I'm the old version of HTML. I was coding by hand back when the internet first started, you know. Like Al Gore was calling me up going, hey D, what are we gonna do with this internet? That's how old I am. So not really. Al Gore is a great person. He didn't actually call me up as a disclaimer, but I was doing HTML coding back in, you know, using the, you know, before it was a thing now. And so I my whole thing was to get all the Darren Grays and then he and I have been fighting for a couple of years now over all the Darren Gray stuff. And like I said, if he ever takes me to court, I got him by 2 years. So I have first rights to the Darren Gray name.
Well, thank you for joining me tonight. I appreciate everything that you say. You dropped a lot of good gems, a lot of them, even making me sit over here and be like, well, dang, I've been going around this the wrong way. So let me figure my life out.
I follow you. You do great things. I follow you. So you do great things. So don't sell yourself short.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. And thank you to everyone who joined in tonight. All the questions, comments. I appreciate you all. And I hope you guys all have a great Wednesday night.
Absolutely. Goodbye.